Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's new daily show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on the facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During the show, we give you access to local officials and experts on COVID-19 and community actions related to it. If you have questions for our guests, please email them to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181. You can find a list of upcoming guests on our Facebook page or on our website, kmxt.org. Audio from each day's program will be posted on the website.
Yeah, pleasant good morning to you. Thanks for tuning in this morning. What's the plan for the upcoming school year? No, more correctly, what's the plans for the upcoming school year? You are all aware that we are living in a challenging time, and the challenges that are currently facing our local educators as they try and make plans for what next year's school year will look like are truly monumental. A core group has been hard at work for months trying to prepare for what the future will be, and we're going to talk with some of them now about it today to try and give you an idea of where we are, where we may be headed. In the studio today, I have Superintendent of Schools Larry Ledoux, Assistant Director of Special Services Kim Saunders, and Neil Heck, the incoming principal for the Kodiak High School. We have a lot of time, a lot of questions, but we're hoping you have questions as well. This is our attempt to get them before you. I know there's a lot of questions out in the community concerning what's happening with the schools. So if you have one, if you'll call or email us, we'll try and get the question to the panel and it answered by the end of our program. So thank you very much for making time to come in and talk with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting us.
Okay, well, let's jump right in. How long have you been at it? Ever since we've been shut down, you've been trying to open up, I assume.
Well, we started planning back in February, very early, just looking at the landscape internationally and started to ask questions of ourselves, what if? And so we started initial discussions back then, and that helped us weather this spring when we had to do an immediate shutdown, helped us to be more prepared to continue education. But we learned a lot. And as we look toward the new year, we collected a lot of information to start ensuring that we would be prepared for the unknown, because we have no idea what the landscape in Kodiak or our nation will look like when school's supposed to start on the 31st of August. So we've been planning for the unknown.
The early indications you had, though, was right around spring break, when you knew that spring break was coming and there was a good possibility you were going to close down. So I would imagine this is an ongoing process that you have. As the school year progressed, you know, there was a thought that, well, maybe we can return for the final, you know, the final month or so to get school finished. And then at some point you just had to give that up.
That's true. It's always our goal to open our schools up and have teachers in front of young people and to have it the way it used to be. And it's been an increasing awareness that while we want that to happen, there are many things that could happen that would challenge that. Mm-hmm. And so, as I said, we're preparing to be flexible. We've got several scenarios based on what's happening in Kodiak, what's happening in our state and the nation. And since the state has now moved that decision-making to the local community, we're trying to make sure that we have enough information to make good decisions about whatever happens.
Now, in any scenario, did you ever think that not opening the school again in September was going to be something you were going to have to plan for?
I don't think anybody in Kodiak or among our staff thought that we would ever be facing this kind of pandemic. We had protocols in place that we developed during the bird flu era when we thought a pandemic would hit the world, but they were very general and not operational. So I think that we've been doing a lot of planning and decision making in the middle of the river. And I think because we're Kodiak, I think we've done that very well, because I think in Kodiak, when times get tough, we work together. And I think that's certainly what happened this spring. We had really good support from our parents, our students, our teachers, our administrators, and our community as a whole. I think we were able to put together a program that allowed us to help kids tread water. That means we really worked hard to prevent regression. Regression is what happens over the summer when kids sort of forget what they've been learning and we have to sort of reacquaint them in the fall. But when it spreads over 5 months, then the regression would be significant. And I think we were able to hold the line on regression. We also put together a very comprehensive summer program that's currently ongoing to support young people K-12. But the difference right now is that we have time to plan. Last spring, it was happening so quick. We just had to make very quick decisions. However, this summer and spring, we've been planning for the fall, and we've been able to involve teachers, administrators, parents, into having some deep discussions on what school will look like if this continues.
So tell me about that planning process. How many people are actually involved? How many active groups do you have?
I believe that, this is Kim Saunders, I believe that there are 6 to 8 committees meeting regularly across elementary and secondary, so they parallel one another. And then each of those committees has kind of broken into subcommittees, if you will, and are tackling different portions of the Smart Start plan that the state has outlined that KIBSD is trying to or is putting together for presentation to our school board and then also to the state level. I don't know the exact number of people that are involved. I would venture to guess upwards of 100 different individual people from different parts of the community in those committees and subcommittees. It's a pretty impressive group of people that are pulling together. You know, summer is notoriously a time in Kodiak when people sort of split or go outside and are not necessarily prepared to attend meeting after meeting. And I have been continuously impressed by the commitment of the community, specifically our families who are really, and our teachers who are really rallying and saying, this is so critical that we're coming to the table and trying to give voice to the plan to support our kids. So it's been a mind-boggling, the whole thing is sort of mind-boggling, but it's also, on the other hand, the same reason I love living here and why I'm here is because that's what this community does, and this is a perfect example of that.
So, Larry, did the committees all, did they form, like, earlier in the year? I know it must have been really challenging to get through the school year itself because there was so much going on and there was so much more work involved. Are these the same people that, during that same period of time, are trying to prepare for not only the summer program, but then the fall program too?
Well, I think that we started our committee process right toward the end of the school year. This spring, we were just trying to get through the year, and I think the teachers and the parents and kids certainly ended the year exhausted. Mm-hmm. And we gave a little bit of time, I think a week, before we started up our committees because the timelines are short. And the government sent out Alaska Smart Start 2020, which laid out the guidelines for developing an education plan. And each community is designed in the state has been asked to submit a plan based on a low, medium, and high risk scenario. And then each plan has to address certain characteristics of schooling, from school safety to curriculum to instruction, the logistics, looking at our networks, looking at our curriculum, looking at how we can keep our kids safe in schools, how we can do social distancing. I mean, it is an unlimited number of challenges that we are facing. When we list the questions that we have to answer, they just keep growing and growing. And everything that we do or decide to do creates ripples that affect something else in the district. And we've had, as Kim indicated, we've had really great support from our committees, and now we'll be spending the next 2 weeks as they start completing their tasks to weave them all together into a comprehensive plan that will allow us to communicate directly with parents what it's going to look like, and to ensure that we're prepared to do this. So we're spending a lot of money preparing, if you will, trying to make sure that we have curriculum and safety protocols in place. And the committees are doing that for us. When you sit in and listen to these committees, they're just doing an incredible job. They're being very specific, they're being flexible, and they're thinking about kids and safety and how we can move forward, because this fall it won't be good enough to prevent regression. Mm-hmm. We have to move forward full speed regardless of the risk factor that we're under. And that's what we're working on, is to try to make sure that happens. And at the same time, keeping our staff and students safe.
So do you operate in a bubble? Are we in our own little micro world here of trying to do this at a local level? You got the guideline that you have from the state of, here's a plan, you fill in the blanks and see how it works the best for your local school district. But everybody in the whole state's in the same position, so I imagine there might be some support out there, right?
Yeah, this is Neil Hecht. We've looked not just around the state, but we've taken a look at other states, North Dakota, California, a New England state as well, and just kind of meshing those together. We've taken a lot from the Kenai District, also the Valley, what Wasilla and Palmer are looking at doing. And we've also extended that also into our sports and activities. So it's difficult at times, but taking a look at what other people are doing, it gives us ideas. And I think a lot of places are still in the planning phases too. So as we look at stuff, we're still in the planning phase. So it's just an ongoing process.
Well, we do have the advantage of having the ability through media to, mm-hmm. Connect with. We know that other countries are slowly reopening their schools. Now we see the American Pediatric Association yesterday came out with recommendations of how schools are going to reopen and why they're going to reopen. So there are other models out there. So I gather then we can look at some of those models and try and fit in with what the committee is considering at a local level.
I think that our committees are tentatively looking at two different models under what we call medium risk. I would say under a low risk model, and under the state guidelines, that would be that we don't have any COVID community spread positives within 2 weeks. Currently, we would not be able to open under the state guidelines under what's low risk. But as I said before, that's a community decision. And a low-risk school would look very much like what we left with before spring break, although with a number of sanitation, social distancing to our ability. For instance, we would be having kids walk through the hallways differently, go upstairs. We would probably not have lunch in the cafeteria. So anything that we could do to increase social distance and keep the kids safe. And there may be a mask policy that some kids would be required to wear masks, or teachers. So we're still looking at that. So that's the area that we would love to open in, because kids see teachers every day. It's stable. But then we have to be ready to seamlessly move to a higher risk category. And that would be the medium risk. And that's where we're spending most of our time. And that's where we have a significant outbreak in our community, but not enough to go to the high risk. And that's where we're going to have to develop plans to split shift, to increase social distancing, to increase safety measures within the school, and while at the same time preserving a continuity of instruction. We can't just be in one risk category and the next day we go to this. We have to be able to seamlessly move instruction from low, medium, and high. And that could happen within 1 week. We won't know. We could have an outbreak on Wednesday night that we find out about and be in the green, and then we immediately the next day have to go to a medium risk that would require changing schedules and moving kids around. I think Neil and Kim could talk specifically about what elementary and secondary might look like under a medium risk. The high risk is essentially remote learning. We did learn a lot this last spring on remote learning, and I think that our community, our teachers, our parents and kids can work together better. We didn't have time to do a lot of things, parent training, curriculum development, teacher training. And I think students, teachers, and parents all learned their limits with regard to remote instruction. So if we go into the high risk, I think we can do that much better than we did this spring and move forward because of the work of our committees and the planning effort.
Okay, so you get this document, for the Smart Start document from the state, and a week goes by to give everybody a chance to catch some breaths, and then you decide to break it up into committees. Give me an idea of what the committees are, who's working on what, and, you know, what those specific challenges of each one of the committees are in regard to moving you from, you know, we're back to normal, there are no cases in the community, to there's a couple of cases, so we're going to be in a medium risk society, and then what happens in the red category?
Well, the state defines three different conditions that they want us to look for. They want us to look for conditions of learning, which would be safety protocols, parent-family engagement, food service, transportation, social-emotional needs. And then continuity of learning is really dealing with instruction and learning. And we don't use these names for our committees per se, but I think one of our major groups is student engagement and parent-family engagement, so that we can learn how to work very closely with our families and really become a team when we have to, and we can all work together. The other is instruction, curriculum and instruction. So we're looking at the kind of changes in curriculum that we might have to implement that would work well in a remote instruction. Some of our curriculum in math, for instance, requires extensive training of our teachers. And sometimes in even the curriculum, the company that sells the curriculum say it's very, very difficult to use. So we have teachers looking at how that would have to be modified so teachers can be partners in it. They're looking at the required training for parents. We're looking at having teachers train parents so that they can work with the curriculum and they'll know how to support it. And then we have the other committee that's very important is logistics and safety. What do we need to do to make all this happen? What does our network look like? What do we need? What's our budget? How do we do student activities? How do we protect our staff? And that's very, very interesting. They're looking at mask policies. They're looking at how we clean our buildings, what we need to do to clean them. They look at what we do if we have a teacher or a student become positive at one of our schools. How would we close up? What would that mean to instruction? How would we jump to the next level? So it's the whole operations component. How do we manage buses when we can only put half the number of students on the bus? It's, they all work together. And so each committee is really dug in, and some of them have a little bit of overlap, as you might think. But they're very, very practical. They even go into if a student is sick in the classroom, should they go to the nurse's office? Because if they find out they're positive, then we have to sanitize the nurse's office. Where do we have kids that are sick? What kind of worksheet should parents go through to determine whether their child should go to school? For instance, some have said we should take temperatures when kids get on the bus. So the bus driver would take a temperature. Well, it doesn't work very well because the kids are cold. And then you're at a bus stop and you're taking temperatures and you have this little kindergarten who's waiting at the bus stop that has a temperature. What do you do with that child? Okay, can you just leave them at the bus stop? No.
That probably wouldn't be
no
well received in the community.
And how long does it take to do that? And how do we move the same number of kids on buses with a social distancing? And what level of social distancing? And so there's just everything, every decision that we make gets more complicated when you see how it's actually going to operate. And are we going to let parents into the schools once we're going to do this? Are we going to let kids use lockers? Are we going to allow backpacks? I mean, I could go on and
so
on.
So yeah, basically you have the 9 to 10 committees that are all individually looking at little aspects like this. But how do you populate each committee? How do you populate those? And what's the cross-section of people that comprise the elements of the community? Because we're dealing with like elementary kids, and then we're dealing with upper elementary and sixth graders and then high schoolers. And it's got to be totally different for each one of those groups, right? So are there members of each one of those three communities involved in a committee?
So I'm with the Curriculum and Instruction, the Continuity of Learning Committee for secondary, which includes high school, middle school. So earlier, I think it was in April or May, an invite went out to anyone interested. So we got a bunch of names. We got a pool of names. And then we went through and started looking at who was there and what their roles are and what their backgrounds are. And so for the secondary, which was middle school and high school, we went through and selected about 16, 17 teachers, educators, you know, different areas of the middle school and high school. So on our committee, we started off with 16, and then some people had some other commitments. So we're down to, I believe, 14 people on the secondary continuity of learning, curriculum and instruction. So we've taken a look at everything from the curriculum to what schedule we would use possibly at each one of those phases, parent engagement, even though it overlaps. We've had discussions with the leaders of other committees, kind of, you know, trying to mesh up what everything looks like, including the safety of, you know, locker use, flow of students. What does it look like in yellow when we have social distancing and possibly 50% capacity, something like that. So we've done a lot of work. We've met 12, 14 hours. We're going to meet some more this month. And then again in August, we've discussed professional development and training and whether we're going to use a type of this type of curriculum or this type of communication platform. What we learned in the spring is less is better. That way parents, especially in a high school, middle school setting, if there's seven different courses, there's not seven different things that parents have to go to. There's one to two to three. And, you know, it's we're taking a lot of that based off parent input, student input from the spring. So it's a large task, but what we've done is we've taken little chunks of it, and we continue to work on it and get input. And sometimes there's differings that go on, just different opinions. And so we whittle down in that and find out what's best for the students. And then we move forward. We put our notes together, and hopefully by sometime in July, we'll be somewhere good.
Yeah. It's a long process, I would imagine. And it sounds like an enormous amount of work as well. So is the core group on all the committees then primarily educators and your support staff? Or do we have outside input into the what's going to happen?
Each committee has family members, community members that are represented in each group. So I would say it's a cross section, but they were all volunteers. So they represent. We tried to widen our net as much as we can and get as different representation from multiple different layers in our community so that everyone's voice could be heard at the table and hopefully develop a plan that addresses lots of different needs. So there's the administrative team is leading that committee work. And then I would say really learning to use our collaborative tools. And as we all moved into virtual instruction, that was part of our learning too, was how do we collaborate best virtually, and how do we get input and voice heard, and then how do we share across, for instance, I'm on the elementary side of the parent and family or family and student engagement committee, and so then having conversations with the secondary team to make sure you're also not doubling up on work and attempting to divide and conquer some of that too is a huge part of it, but it's a steep learning curve for everyone. Mm-hmm.
And your turnaround time isn't a long time. I mean, you know, it seems like summer's a long time, but by the time the last year ended and now you're dealing with this, you're going full bore on to try and get things in place before the school year opens, right?
Absolutely.
So how far along into the process are you now? I mean, is it continuing to evolve on a daily basis, or do you have a pretty good idea of where you're at now and where we're going to go in September or August?
I think that it's our intent to have a framework developed with some specificity by July 15th. And that's our target. And we hope at that point in time to be able to bring it to the school board, but also to distribute to the community, because we want to know what they think, how they feel. Parents are sending their children to school during a worldwide pandemic, and they're rightly concerned with what we do and how we do it and the safety of their children. So we want to have the plan together so that we can have discussions with our community, with our parents and our community as a whole, so that we can craft the program that fits where the community is. I think Kim and Neil can talk about, you know, elementary and secondary with some specificity with the framework we're looking at right now, especially in what we call the medium risk category, or where we would have a blended program where it's going to be some face-to-face and some remote, and that would be the medium risk. And if you looked at the state guidelines, that's where we would be right now, but that's not necessarily what we would do if today was August 31st. Again, we would look at advice from our medical community. We would look at best practice. We would try to make the best decision that keeps our kids safe. And that's a complicated question.
So this is really a partnership, really, with you and the Emergency Services Organization as well. I mean, aren't they like strong partners in making you making decisions? And how quickly does your plan then depend on information and input from them and from a medical team?
Well, the Emergency Services Office under Mike Tavenghi has been a great support to everything that we do. I listen in on their meetings. They offer great advice. They come from many facets of the community. So recently the board passed a resolution, the school board, thanking them for their efforts to help us move through this crisis and to keep our kids safe. So as we move forward in developing our plan, we're working hand in hand with the community's safety and mitigation plan. We can't be separate. So I think we have a good relationship, and that will continue.
What I mean is, you know, in the big picture, we have the governor and his mandates and the Dr. Zinc, but now they pass down the responsibility for implementation of a local plan to you. And I kind of look at it as now it becomes a partnership between you and the ESC as the substitute at a local level for how things work from the state level, right?
I think that is correct. When we say the state has abdicated decision-making to the community, it does mean the community. And with regard to the safety or management of the crisis is the Emergency Services Council, and we work, as I said, with them. So it is a partnership, and we had a meeting this morning, and we talked about how that would work together. And I'm very, very pleased with the level of cooperation with the borough and the city to keep our schools safe and to help us through this crisis. So we're good partners.
I guess what I'm asking is the input then is going to be fairly instantaneous, or are you going to be able to rely on a medical team or the ESC to give you advice as to whether or not you need to move to level two, level three?
We will have some of those discussions ahead of time, and so they won't be, you know, extemporaneous completely, but we've just started to put our medical advisory group together, but ultimately the decision will be, you know, mine to make. And to a certain extent, you know, I wake up in the middle of the night thinking, gosh, why did they make it local? If the state just told us what to do, my job would be a lot easier. But I share dual responsibilities. I have to educate our children, and I have to keep them safe. And weighing those, I'll be relying on advice from the broader community, EOC, medical community, the school board. And I think, just like has been said before, it'll be a community decision. And we'll make it happen. We'll make it happen for kids.
Those are lonely shoes to be in there, Larry. It's a lot of responsibility. In an optimal situation, where would we be when school starts?
Well, where we would be when school starts is we'd have such a low incidence of COVID in our community that we could open school with just a number of social distancing and sanitation and safety guidelines. That's where I would like to be. It's never going to be the way it was before spring break. You know, it's a worldwide pandemic. People are dying, not in our community yet, but across our nation. And we're going to have to work through it and we'll work through it together. I know I keep saying that, but it's what I believe. And it's what Kodiak is very good at. So I may be lonely, but I'm really not alone because there are so many people here who are committed to the welfare of our kids, our schools, and community. But it is a balancing act because when you talk about safety, there is no absolute safety. Everything is a risk. We have playgrounds on every school that kids break their arms on every year. Should we get rid of all of our playgrounds? No, we should. There's other ways to keep them safe. So we have a COVID epidemic in our nation, in our state, but so far it hasn't hit Kodiak that hard since March, but that may change. So we have to look at what's happening in the community, what's been happening recently, and seek the best advice and then make the best decision. But what I would hope would happen is that we would open in green, but I can't say that that will happen at this point in time. But
since this virus isn't going to go away anytime soon, this green level is something that we're going to have to live with for 2 or 3 years or maybe longer, which puts an enormous load on you to do extra things that you didn't anticipate. I mean, there's got to be a huge staff load here that wasn't anticipated, and then there's a financial load that we're not really talking about.
Well, I'm not really alone. I have an incredible administrative team that has essentially given up their entire summer without any rest at all and are working every day. And I have teachers that are committing some for compensation, some on their own time. I have classified employees. So standing behind me is a great group of people, so I never feel alone. And so I'm feeling like we have great people working to put together a plan for Kodiak that will work for us. And, you know, we're looking around the nation. Everybody's in the same boat. The advantage that we have is that we're not working against each other here. Mm-hmm. Although sometimes I was thinking this morning on what to put on our school sign, in front of our school too, so that we could open, and it was safe community, safe schools, wear a mask. That means if we can prevent it in our community, then we can open our schools the way we want to. But if we don't take care of ourselves, if we don't act on advice to prevent it from spreading, then that decision will affect whether we can open schools or not. Because if we have an outbreak here, then we're going to have to go to a risk scenario that we don't want to be in. I don't want to have schools in high risk or medium. I want them open. I want teachers in front of kids. I want kids in front of their friends. And I want teachers to be able to teach on their strengths and the relationships. And, you know, one of the biggest challenges, and it's often forgotten, that we had and is really sort of the overlay that we look at everything we do is equity. And that's fairly important to me because, you know, I come from a generation where my parents, World War II, where they worked hard, knowing that if they worked hard, their children, through education, could have a better life. And that's a real big responsibility. And when you're looking at equity, what do we can put together a program, but we have to put together a program that will equalize education, that will assure that every child, regardless of the support they have at home or their conditions or their socioeconomic status, can receive an education. You know, we have a responsibility to keep that the dream that education is the pathway to a better future. And that is the biggest responsibility, is not just to make decisions with committees, but to have every committee focused on individual children so that whatever we do, we can equalize it. Some of our kids, you know, when kids are in front of a teacher at school, we're the great equalizer. We can feed them, take care of them, hug them, meet their needs. I don't know how much money the Lions Club has spent buying glasses or helping a child with a tooth problem. And, you know, our community comes together, but when schools close down, we lose that. And that's the big challenge I face, and that's what I worry most about. Mm-hmm. I have good people keeping kids safe. I have great teachers, incredible teachers, and classified staff that are committed. But we have to have a plan that ministers to the needs of every child. And that's what I get passionate about. I don't worry about the logistics. I don't worry about what I call things. because we can overcome things. We can overcome logistical challenges and safety challenges and instructional challenges. What I worry about is that we can take care of all of our kids and keep them safe and educated. So, and I think I'm not alone in thinking that, but that's the real responsibility I have, is to create a system. I asked one of our employees one day, why do you work three jobs? And he said, I have two kids in college. Like, why would you even ask? You know, and that puts an incredible commitment on us to make sure that whatever we do, that hard work that parents do for their children, that we'll have an education system that will help that dream come alive. So it might be good just to maybe have Kim or Neil share one of the couple of the frameworks that we're looking at.
Okay, let me just do one follow-up on you. That's in a traditional environment. You have that load all the time. That's your primary focus of education. The problem with the green and the system that we're moving into when COVID becomes, it just makes it that much more difficult for you to try and transition and still offer that level of services. So that's probably what you're trying to work through on some of these committees, right?
Very, very much so. And I think I made it clear to all of the principals. They've heard my comments before on this, and they've shared the same thing with me, that we have to equalize it. So I think all of our committees are keeping that in mind as they move forward. We're not just looking for a way to get through this. We're looking for a way to get through this in the right way that recognizes what our mission is and our goals for kids.
But I guess what I'm asking you specifically, though, when we're talking about the load on you to actually be able to deliver this at different levels, even at the green level right now, is unanticipated costs to your operation that didn't exist before. If you're already having some budget issues, this has got to cost an enormous amount of money to deal with the sanitizers and the sanitation of the building and add extra staff on for all of the requirements that are here. How much? And we're talking about, you know, whether or not we're going to have the same number of students in the school system that contributes financially to you. I mean, how are we sitting in terms of that? How are we financially prepared to go forward?
Well, you're right. There is going to be considerable expense associated with almost everything we do. Just adopting the curriculum for the elementary level is very, very expensive. If we were to supply masks for kids, it would be several hundred thousand dollars a year if we went in that direction. We haven't made that determination, but we are spending money. The state or the federal government through the CARES Act allocated about $580,000 to us, which may seem like a lot of money, but it is not. I guarantee that. We're hoping, and we're watching every nickel and dime we can, that the borough will share some of their CARES money with us. The school board has written a letter to the assembly sharing some of our needs. And they're well over $1 million. And that's with a very conservative approach. Because when you need personnel to sanitize, when you need curriculum, when you need safety measures, the sanitizers that we need to fog our buildings and keep them safe are just under $24,000, assuming we can get them. Putting shields on desks, masks for staff.
Changing the bathrooms.
Oh, goodness, that was trying to stop kids from passing it, putting touchless toilets and sinks so kids don't have to grab that handle.
You're dealing with new iPads, right? And you've got tubs for people to bring their gear home. The lockers are shut off. I mean, everything sort of adds up. And then the transportation costs, you sort of, we talked about a little before of...
Well, and what's difficult is that I have to order this now when I don't know if I'm going to have the money or it won't be here. We've ordered foggers. I mean, they're sanitizers that essentially sanitize a whole room under the desk everywhere back in March, and we still haven't received them yet. Everything is back ordered. We're building plexiglass screens to protect secretaries. The list is very, very long, and we have to move on it immediately.
But then you got a construction crew that's going to have to go into every one of the schools and start doing all this work in the next 6 weeks, right?
Yes. Besides, we have to go into every classroom in the district and make sure that if we go to the social distancing, how many kids can we put in the classroom? How are we going to deliver lunches to kids in their own classrooms, because we can't put them in the cafeteria under any level? And that's what logistics is looking into. How do we do that? But what we know is that whatever planning we do, it probably won't be enough. There's going to be a lot of decisions that we make as we move through the process. Problems will reveal themselves. But we do believe that we're building a framework that will get schools started, that will be consistent, that will be a challenge. Our administrators, were gathered several weeks ago, and we were looking at this task. How are we going to do it? How are we going to involve the community? And people were saying, there's no summer. There's no rest. Our principals are exhausted from just this spring. It was round the clock to be ready. Very proud of them, and the community should be. But then they sat down and realized that, without overusing the statement, we're not in Kansas anymore. That nobody can make it right anymore. People are dying across our nation. Our economy is being challenged. People are scared. And we're making one of the most massive changes in the history of our nation in education. And we're doing it in an environment where everybody is afraid. Mm-hmm. People are worried about their loved ones here. They're worried about transportation. They're worried about pains in their chest that they can't have checked out. And we're making changes in the most stable institution in our country that are unprecedented. And that's why I'm proud to be in Kodiak, because people are pitching in. There isn't anybody in this community that I have asked for help, teacher, administrator, that won't step in and say, what can we do to help out? The problem is we don't know what questions to ask yet. We don't know what help we need. That's what we're working on. So in that environment, we're prepping to greet little kids so that they'll be happy, that they'll be, have that stability. Our lunch program, I understand we're feeding kids, and we're very proud of that. And if you go up there and just interview all the workers, they're in a great mood. They're singing. They're doing things. They know it's important. But what's really cool about our lunch program is the stability it provides these kids. They go out to these buses, and you can see them. And that's something that they count on. Parents tell me their kids are going, when is lunch coming? And it's not because they're hungry, per se. That's true in some cases, I'm sure. But it's the connection to schools and the stability and the part of their life that they can't do. So in any case, I don't mean to. I really would like Kim or Neil to talk about some of the frameworks that we're looking at that we're investigating very closely right now. If that's
sure, I'll go. Some of the frameworks, and without getting into too many details, is one of the things that, as I'm thinking about yellow and red, is our schedule, our bell schedule. What does that look like when the high school enrollment 610? How do I bring in half of those and half on another day? Is that an A-B schedule? Is that a half and half during the day? Trying to align that with elementary, taking input from the community. That's one of the frameworks that I'm looking at. Curriculum that will allow us to seamlessly go between green, yellow, red in any situation. If at 8 o'clock at night we get a call that tomorrow there's no school for the next 3 days, how do we keep kids engaged? With minimal changes with what we had in the spring, where students are going to several different sources, minimal sources to have to go to, minimal platforms for parents to communicate. So those are the big frameworks. And then getting it from the others, like I had said earlier, the safety of the building, students walking. We have 7 classes, that's 6 different transition times. So there's going to be, even if half the students are there, 300 students in the hall, and being able to have them flow through the building and get a lunch or go to the restroom, all these bigger things that we're going to have to, and I said before, whittle down as it gets closer and have a very informed plan that we can put out to the community as well as our staff with the basics at least, and then be able to change on a dime if we have to go into a yellow or red. So that's kind of the big picture items we're looking at secondary.
Yeah, and it's very similar at elementary. I think Larry really really articulated it well when he said that, you know, we're attempting to plan. It's like I'm thinking of it as our insurance policy. I want to know, worst case scenario, what's this going to look like, and how do I plan for it as best that we can? The elementary team is all focused on what will virtual instruction look like and be like, and how can we do it better than we did it in the spring for growth instead of just maintenance, right? So I think the committee work is really trying to say, what would this look like practically? And it's absolutely from families and from community members saying, whatever it is, give us stability, right? Please make sure we know what time to be online and when, whether we're yellow, whether we're red, so we can attempt to stabilize our life. That's the call from our families, really, ultimately. And he's done a nice job of saying we're the great equalizer or the great stabilizer traditionally, and so attempting to maintain that role in the face of this completely unpredictable, extraordinary circumstance is the great challenge. Having said that, right now, basically, you're looking at 100% of students coming to the buildings in green with increased safety measures. In yellow, you're looking at half of the students coming for a half day elementary. So a student would be either an AM student or a PM student. And the second part of their educational program would be virtual. So a student might come 4 days a week only to the building, mornings, and then in the afternoon they would receive the rest of their program virtually, or the reverse of that. Secondary right now is looking at 2 days a week. So that would be a Tuesday, Thursday, or a Wednesday, Friday, actually on campus. And I know people are challenged with even saying that out loud or talking about it, is we don't know exactly yet if that's where we will land. But it's certainly where the conversation is at this moment. And so if people are trying to wrap their brains around what might this look like, I think that might be helpful information. And then red being 100% virtual or level, the high risk level.
So, Neil, if I heard you correctly, at a green level, the high school would still only half the kids would come at a time?
No, that's in the yellow.
That's in yellow. Okay.
Right.
So we go from 100% at green to half at yellow to no one at red.
Correct.
Pretty much.
And how long would we stay at red? I mean, is that we have to wait 14 days before there's no further cases and then we can drop down a level? Or do you have some discretion as to whether or not you can move around?
Well, the same decision to go to a higher risk level would be the same decision to go back. We would have to look at the factors involved. But the kind of outbreak that would force us into red probably won't go away in a day or two, because we're at that point in time, we're looking at a severe increase in our community, and to the point where if you look at the community mitigation plan, they would go to red, and that would be similar to the shutdown, I suspect, that they did before. When our community shuts down. And so I don't necessarily see that happening. But I will say this, if we were in red and we felt we could go to yellow, the program that we're developing would allow us to do that and still maintain continuity of instruction. Mm-hmm. So that's our whole plan. We don't know what risk level we'll be in, but whatever we're in, we'll be ready for it and we'll be ready to move either way if the situation merits that.
So for the parent at home with children, they can anticipate, if they're listening to the news, that depending on what our COVID counts are on Thursday at the meetings, that's going to directly affect how school would open in August. And by monitoring that on kind of a daily basis, I mean, the load on parents must be tremendous to try and plan for what you're going to do here, mm-hmm. not knowing things that change could change from day to day.
I think it is a real load on parents, and I think Kim articulated they are looking for some kind of stability to plan daycare and their jobs around. Whatever the school does, when we declare a snow day, it shuts down the community because people can't go to work because they have to take care of their kids. And so
this is like a snow day that lasts a year.
Well, exactly. But I think that we're trying to develop a program that will provide that knowledge beforehand. But as Neil said, if we had a case in a building, we'll have to close for 3 days. One district wants to close for 14 days if they have a case of a staff member. And there's different plans all over the district. One district in Alaska is going to divide their kids up into A and B, and they meet for 1 week. One group meets for a week, and the other group doesn't meet, and then they alternate weeks. And that, we don't believe, and I don't want to criticize another plan, but with elementary kids in particular and secondary, you need some kind of continued instruction. You can't wait. And that's why we want to get these elementary kids in as much as possible.
Well, that is interesting. So there is communication with other districts throughout the state as to see what they're coming up with. And you can kind of mix and match and say, you know, I really like what Fairbanks is doing in this regard. This might work well in our district.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you don't have to create the whole thing by yourself all the time.
No, you're just shaping it to fit Kodiak to the best of your ability and taking the input from our community. Mm-hmm.
Talk to me a little bit more about the responsibility for, you know, for testing. The comment we got was parents are responsible for their kids. If they have symptoms, they shouldn't be sending them to school. But on your end, I mean, you kind of have to step into this monitoring role, right?
Well, that parent is right. Parents are responsible to ensure that their kids are healthy before they send them to school, and they should make sure that they don't have any symptoms of the flu or any kind of sickness, and they should be taking care of that, and we rely on that. But we also have learned through the years that many kids may come to school sick anyway. It's a judgment call by parents, but when kids come to school, we're going to be very zero tolerant. If you have a child with a fever, they're going to go home. Now, how we're going to take their temperature isn't as simple. We probably will be doing temperature checks, but you can't do it when they walk in the school building because they're cold and it influences the temperature. So just trying to take everybody's temperature is a logistical challenge in itself, and we have to evaluate that. But we will be sending home a checklist for parents that will ask them to ask these questions of every child before they send them on the bus. But I guarantee there'll be kids coming that are sick, and we'll have examination rooms available. So not within the nurses, but next to the nurse's office, where if we have a child with a fever, they'll sit there until their parents come to get them. And then we'll sanitize the room again and move from there. So yeah, we will depend on our parents, but we can't always depend that, you know, a child may get sick on the way to school and the parents won't know it.
Well, it was interesting to listen to the Pediatric Society folks yesterday talk about the justifications for opening schools, and their focus was a lot on the fact that the kids are not the transmitters of the disease. I don't know medically if this is true or not, but their take was the transmission is mostly adult to adult, and that what they were more worried about was the older the kid got, that was a potential transmission site. I mean, so I guess my question is, the people that seem like they would be most at risk in your building are your staff.
Well, that's correct. And we have staff that are high risk. And we're looking at how do we meet the needs of a staff member that's high risk.
How do you do that?
Listen, communicate, do the best we can to keep staff safe. Sometimes move them to a different position. We don't know. But I know this, that we'll do the best we can to meet the needs of every student and staff in our district. And we'll just have to do it on a case-by-case basis. Ultimately, teachers have to teach kids, but there are many ways to do that. So we haven't had a chance to survey our staff because it's very personal information, but we will do that before school starts, or provide staff with an opportunity to let us know the medical challenges they might face. But teachers will be, at this point, in time. I'm required to wear a mask. I suspect at the secondary level, we'll be wearing masks in schools. That could change. I'm just going to let Kim is a preschool expert. I want her to share what she thinks about our littles wearing masks. And
my hope is that we'll be able to use social distancing and hand washing and good sanitation practices. And
are you talking about kindergartners?
No, I'm talking about the littles, three to five.
Okay.
Our preschool program or our primary levels, and that they wouldn't have to wear masks. I think you're creating a situation where kids would play with their mask. You would have potential like hands around your mouth, which is the very thing you're trying to avoid more than you would if you didn't wear a mask. So I think to some degree you create a challenge by introducing them to the smallest children. But again, that decision for elementary in general hasn't been made completely, and it will depend on lots of different factors, I think, when we come to that.
How concerned are you about whether or not you're going to have a full enrollment?
We'll be, once we have our plan, our framework fairly well defined, and this will be probably the last week in July, on the start of the last week in July, we'll be sending information out to every family. This is the secondary program we're looking at. These are the options that we're looking at under each of the categories. And the real question is, how comfortable would you be sending your child to school under these categories? So if we open in green and 50% of our parents saying, I'm not sending my child to school because of whatever reason they feel, then we'll have to be able to respond to that. And so we're, to a certain extent, we're having to identify a remote learning strand in a direct instruction strand in case that happens. But we don't know. I ask parents commonly, if we were to have school today and we were going to open with increased sanitation, hand washing, and all of those strictures in place, would you send your child to school? And about half and half say yes or no.
So we might be at red anyway. I mean, half the kids might be in school and half the kids you're supplying distance education to all the time anyway.
There's no black and white to this plan.
Yeah.
This plan is, I can just say at this point, but we have to be able to respond to any scenario that comes up, including whether parents feel uncomfortable sending their kids to school. And we have to be able to deal with that because they're the ultimate decision makers, not us.
So specifically, like, what kind of accommodations do you have to make for special service? There has to be a lot of things that you're talking about that are, you know, special to certain, and it seems like over the years, you know, the amount of different types of education that you have to provide has increased as well. So this just adds another layer onto that, right?
Absolutely. The special programming and the individual programming for students is a typical challenge that we face, now made even more challenging by the circumstances that we're all in. I think my best answer for how will we handle individual student needs is how we always do, which is individually. Not to be flippant about that, but to truly say, there has never been a time, I've been in special education for 20 years now, and there has never been a time when an IEP team has been more critical, when family input to designing a plan that will work for each individual child is just going to be heavily reliant on what that team believes is best for a kid and then any child, and then the district will respond to those needs individually. We have to, and we want to, both. I always say we're too small in Kodiak not to do this well, right? And that's our greatest strength, is our ability to respond to individual needs. One question that's come up frequently and is an example of that is, you know, if elementary and secondary don't line up, so what Mr. Hecht and I just described, where secondary would come 2 days a week in a medium risk, right? And elementary would come morning and afternoon. What do you do in a situation where a high school student is responsible for childcare or supporting their siblings in their learning program? You know, those are individual concerns. And Neil and I talk a lot about what are we going to do and how, what's that going to look like? But the answer is always the same, which is we will address individual student needs the very best that we can always. And that's one of the reasons that Dr. Ledoux is such an incredible leader, is at the end of the day, that will always be the answer. So I think today, as I think about the community trying to wrap their brain around what their child's school program is going to look like, it's like, we're going to get through it together. And as long as families can continue to communicate with us and continue to be open about what they need or what their student requires, we'll do everything we can to make that program work for that individual child.
Do we have the resources to be able to offer all the additional services then that are going to be required?
I think that to a certain extent we're going to depend on COVID money from the borough to do some of the things that we have to do. At this point in time, we're keeping a close eye on our budget, our fund balance. Our budget for this coming year was cut from our request initially, so and we're responding to that. I'm not complaining. It is what it is. And so we're working within that constraint, and we're looking at our fund balance, what it might be. We're looking at our insurance costs, everything to inform us on what we need to do. And to a certain extent, I have to take risks. I have to order some things or I won't have them for the start of school. And so the board has given me permission to do what I need to do and then come back later and to a certain extent ask for discretion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, the people cost involved. Do we have enough teachers and enough support staff and enough additional people that are going to be in charge of extra sanitation? In this environment, I imagine hiring might be fairly challenging. And in a COVID environment, maybe you may see more people who don't want to come back to this environment and be a teacher, so you might lose people through attrition too. I mean, are we going to have enough people on the ground to help you do what you want to do?
Well, we've lost a couple teachers so far in the district, well past the deadline when we offer jobs to people, some of them are pulling back, and we know that we have a lot of staff members whose families are in harm's way down south, and they're worried about, you know, being able to support them. And so, yes, it's safe to say superintendents across the state are very worried about losing staff members who just say, I can't do this anymore. So far, we've been reasonably stable. We're still looking for a choir teacher. We're looking for a culinary arts teacher at the high school, a math teacher at the middle school, and a fisheries teacher half-time. And
two special education teachers, if I may.
Yes, but hopefully we're on the right track there. And we're going to need more staff to especially help with sanitation. Our custodial staff per square footage is probably the lowest. I mean, we don't have as many as we should. And we're going to have to sanitize completely every building every night, unless we're in a red zone. And if we have a case that affects the school, then we're going to have to close the school and do deep sanitation. And that's besides everything else that we're doing. So, yes, we're going to need more staff. Depending on what kind of remote responsibilities we have, how many kids, parents, want remote or some other form, I'll have to have staffing for that. So everything is flexible. Principals know that when school starts, depending on what happens, we'll have to move people around. I will tell you, though, we are not cutting our arts program. We are not cutting our physical education program. Those are critical to our success, and we're going to do as many activities as we can. And if we can't do varsity sports because of what's happening, even though we've got so far, we're doing a little bit. Neil's coming up with all kinds of plans to keep kids active. Our PE teachers are meeting district-wide to figure out what they could do to keep our kids fit in whatever zone. And so, no, we're not we're not going to back off. Sometimes when you cut those programs during tough times, you can't get them back even when you get money.
Mm.
They have to be protected, and they're part of kids' success. So, and we have special services, which Kim works with. We have kids that need language help. We have kids that are migrant that need support, gifted, talented kids. I'm missing one big group here. And we have rural sites, too. And, well, we're putting together a plan for the town, but in rural sites, we'll be working with the community to customize a plan that fits them. So we could have East shut down and the rest of our schools are opening, or we could be in red and the village schools could be in green.
That's one question I did have. It is set up to where things could change from one school to another school, right?
In our rural schools, yes, the high school could be closed and the elementaries could be open. It just depends on where the case is, what public health says about the connections to other buildings. So we are a flexible group.
So I know from prior discussions that the people, when they came in from St. Mary's and from the Christian school, were more than complimentary about the work that you did to help them get through the end of the school year. Are you working with those folks again to try and get them back going?
Absolutely. They're great partners. They're all Kodiak kids. And they all usually end up at the high school, and we work very well together, and we have great respect for the programming they do and the support for kids and families. So that's another unique thing about Kodiak, you know. Kids are just kids in Kodiak.
So you were helping them work through the process to go through this kind of a plan as well?
Absolutely.
Okay. What can people in the community do at this time to participate in the process or to help you do what you're trying to do?
Wear a mask? No. I think, and that is that to keep talking with their kids, to respond to our requests for information. We're really trying to find better ways to communicate with all of our parents. We're going to stop sending out lengthy letters that I find out people don't read. And we're going to do more infographics to communicate. And one of the things that we did really well this spring, and I'm very proud of our whole program this spring, in spite of the challenges, it was a good start, is we provided translation services, helplines. We translated our documents into Spanish and Tagalog, and we had call line help desks available into the evening, so parents could call and say, what does this mean? And we see the importance of that. So we're communicating on Facebook, on our website, which we're redesigning it, you know, to provide better information. And we're really trying to analyzed effective ways to get information to parents back and forth. But if we do that, then we need to be able to hear back, because once we get the framework, we're going to call every family. We're not going to send out a survey. We're going to call every family and talk to them directly and find out what they're thinking about, what their fears are, and what their choices are. And that will give us the information to fine-tune what we're doing and to do the changes necessary. We do know that we have to do extensive parent training. We know that we have to do teacher training and student training. And this spring, we weren't able to do any of that. So one of the things that we'll probably be requesting is more in-service time. So currently, we're scheduled to start on August 31st, but that may be delayed a week, depending on the kind of training that we need to do, because I know the elementary teachers want to meet with every family, if you will, and meet with their families, talk about, here's our math program, here's how we're going to do it. If we do have to go to remote, we're going to send tubs home that have everything you could ever imagine in them that they can open up. But they're going to make sure parents understand how they can support our math program, our reading and writing program at the elementary, and then how they can promote physical fitness and health. And so we're going to do that, and we're going to do a lot of staff training, because they didn't learn remote learning in schools. They've had to come up to speed on technology, just like families. And for some people, they just flowed right into it, and for some teachers, they need more training. And students need training. So a lot of in-service work.
Boy, you got a lot of work to do.
Can I? This is Kim. Just to add a bird's eye view to that, question of what we can do as a community, you know, I just keep coming back to the adage that it's really going to take a village. And I can't let go of that. That's what this whole next year is going to require for our kids to continue learning what they need to learn to be successful and to be supported from a social emotional standpoint all around. I think about employers, I think about the businesses in our little tiny community that are attempting to support their own employees. You know, sick leave is a privilege, if you will, right? And when we start talking about a child needing to be home for 2 weeks to quarantine, that's going to create this spiral throughout our whole town. And it's really going to require everyone to bend and be flexible and to try to support families. And so I just keep coming back. It really, whether you have a child in the school system or not, this is going to impact everyone. And we all can be more flexible always with each other and kind and really try to stretch as much as we possibly can to support families and children. So I think it's everybody's job to come to the table here. And we're trying our best to plan for that, you know. But that flexibility is going to have to be extended all around.
You know, thank you all for what you're doing. It just sounds like an enormous amount of work that's ahead of you, but you've got a good handle on where you're going. I would love to have you come back in a month or so we can figure out where you're at then, because it seems like it's something that's changing on a daily basis in a good way, because there's people thinking about all these issues that are out there. I just hope that we can open it in green so that the kids can at least get together. Mm-hmm. And the social component is really scary to me, of not being able to be in a social group that you can bond with to form part of the classroom. I think that's just critical.
No, I agree. And, you know, without school, kids can only really communicate on the internet, and that's not the best way.
No. So thank you for what you're all doing. I hope the community stands up for you, appreciates for what you do, and becomes your partner in making next year's school year as successful as we can make it.
Well, I just want to take this point to recognize that the Kodiak Island Borough School District passed a resolution thanking KMXT for all that they're doing to help our community come together and to communicate during this crisis. And I know of no resolution like that, but I know that people really appreciate it. And I know our school board appreciated it enough to pass that resolution at their last meeting. And we do appreciate what you do in the community.
Mm-hmm. We're all the same community, you know, and the more that we can do to come together as a community, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
You've been listening to The Lowdown here on KMXT 100.1 FM and HD. We're also streaming live on the web at kmxt.org.